Hi, welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballinger, and it's great to have you here with us. You can get a hold of me on Twitter, at Ryan Ballinger. You can get a hold of Golf News Net on your favorite social media service, at the handle Golf News Net. And we are presented by our friends at ShotScope. ShotScope is the ultimate game performance tracking platform. I have been using ShotScope all this entire season, and we're going to continue to document my journey with it, actually putting out a piece this week on Golf News Net, kind of digging into the early numbers on my season. Kind of talk about where I've struggled, where I can get better, where I thought I would be struggling, and where the reality actually is. So you can follow that series over at golfnewsnet.com, as well as on social media through my Twitter account, which is really the only place I do social media personally, which is at Ryan Ballinger. But head to shotscope.com to find more. You'll learn more about their great product. You'll learn more that you can have a GPS watch on your wrist while you play that collects the shot data on your behalf using its GPS instead of having to use your phone's GPS. You not have to keep your phone in your pocket, and you can track your rounds very easy, very simply through the ShotScope platform, and then go on to their great app or their website, get great data for your rounds. Shots are recorded via GPS. They're mapped against the overhead view of the golf course. Get a better sense of where you're gaining strokes, what you're doing with each club in the bag. You have a better, if not total, awareness of what you're doing when you play golf. And that is the first step in getting better, is knowing what in the world you're doing wrong, which may range from as little as chipping and putting to literally everything. But the more you know, as NBC used to say, it helps you get better at golf. So check out ShotScope, ShotScope.com. Check them out now. After you're done listening to this podcast, and we'll tell you more about ShotScope in the coming weeks here on the show and at Golf News Net. All right, so I wanted to kind of break this thing into two parts, of course. We've got the PGA Championship. Brooks Koepka winning that. We'll react to that. And then in the second half of the show, I want to talk about the experience I had being in the Pinehurst area, the Pine Needles area, Southern Pines, for the U.S. Senior Women's Open, and a couple of things around that. So we'll wrap the show with that in the second half. But I want to react to what happened in the PGA Championship with Brooks Koepka being now a four-time major champion. I think it's kind of important to set the table in terms of where he is historically now. He's won four majors in about the same number of starts as Tiger Woods won his first four majors. So he won the 97 Masters, the 99 PGA, and then he won the 2000 U.S. Open, and the 2000 British Open. That's his first four. So he won those over a space of effectively 3 years. And then you include, well, really it's 4 years. But then you look at what Brooks Koepka did. He obviously didn't do as well at the front end, didn't win his first major start as a professional, but kind of struggled to figure it out a little bit as he gained a foothold in the game, maybe learned from people who were better than him. He kind of took those things and put them into a formula that works for him, the way that he approaches majors. And now he has won four of the last eight played, and he missed one of those. So that's a pretty incredible run for anybody not named Woods or Nicklaus. That's a remarkable run. And he's the first guy in the history of the sport to be the two-time defending champion of multiple majors at the same time. He's the two-time defending champion of the U.S. Open next month, and he is the two-time defending champion of the PGA Championship for another year. That's pretty crazy. That doesn't happen. It hasn't happened. And now he's in a company where he already has the career of Rory McIlroy in the space of 24 months. Mind you, McIlroy hasn't won a major since 2014, so it's getting increasingly unlikely that he will suddenly add to that tally. You've got Jordan Spieth, who is on three majors, hasn't won one in a couple of years. That doesn't seem that bad, but when you look where his game has gone in the last couple of years, it's kind of hard to imagine he will suddenly become 2015 Jordan Spieth again. That in anything, he would become kind of like 2017 Jordan Spieth again, and we'll get to his weekly performance separately. We'll get to those guys' performance separately. Then you have Dustin Johnson, who did put himself close. He got to within a stroke. I mean, obviously aided by four consecutive bogeys in the middle of the back nine for Koepka, but got himself close and then immediately went away as soon as he got within a shot with back-to-back bogeys on 16-17. Of course, difficult course on Sunday. Bethpage Black was much different on Sunday. A lot of wind, much firmer. It was tough. And so you kind of have to expect some bogeys. But, of course, the timing was not fortuitous, and it doesn't help the narrative that DJ chokes, even though he tries to portray himself as playing as a cool customer, completely uninterested in the result. The history tells you otherwise, that he does care, and that he does get nervous, and that he does make mistakes when he gets close. And this was another example of that. And then to kind of swing to the other end, Brooks Koepka is one major away from his peers in terms of generational peers. You swing the other way, and he's one major away from the career of Phil Mickelson. Is there any doubt he's going to get another one? I mean, I don't know that it'll be Pebble Beach, but is there any doubt that he's going to get another one? I mean, I think it's pretty certain at some point he's going to win the Masters once, if not multiple times. I mean, he's gotten closer and closer every time he's played, and just by logic, the only way he can move up at this point is to win the thing. So I think that is kind of inevitable. He seems custom built for most U.S. Opens. Maybe not Pebble. We'll talk about that. Maybe not Pebble, but maybe Pebble. I don't know. We'll just see what the USGA has in store with a new setup man at the helm for the U.S. Open. So that's something to consider. And then he's going to be in the PGA Championship mix for at least the next 10 years. I mean, his clubhead speed is not going to decline anytime soon. He's still going to swing at about 120 to 125 miles per hour for the foreseeable future. He's going to keep hitting the gym, so it's not like his muscles are going to go away. He's still going to be a guy who is tremendously fit and uses that to his advantage. He's going to use his upper body strength to guide the golf swing and allow him to hit it a long way. And that's going to give him a perpetual advantage over the field, or at least make him no worse than the longest players in the field. And the longest players in the field, as we've kind of figured out over time, aren't really the best players, usually. And even if they are longer than everybody else, they have a fatal flaw that prevents them from winning so frequently. Think about Rory McIlroy, that CBS pointed out in their telecast on Sunday. He has the exact same swing speed as Brooks Koepka, the average swing speed about 123 miles per hour with the driver on the PGA Tour. They hit it about the same length, more or less, and that's just a function of how fast you can swing it. I mean, if you can swing it this fast, and the maximum smash factor you can have is 1.52, well, there you go. Just think about it in your head. 1.5 off of 123. Done and dusted. So if you think about it that way, you know, you're looking at the ball speed factor, which is also kind of, you know, similar deal. I mean, they have about 180 ball speed, so the smash factor is 1.5. You do the math. It carries 280, 290, somewhere in that range, and then rolls out from there. And that's why those guys are so long. And when they really nut it, then it goes, you know, 300, 310 in terms of carry and rolls out even farther than that. But Koepka is very accurate off the tee. So is Rory. But Rory's horrible with wedges and short irons. Brooks is not. He's good with them. And he's a capable enough putter that when he does hit flawed shots with those short irons, there's not instant pressure on his game to make a two-putt and avoid an embarrassing bogey. You have Dustin Johnson, on the other hand, just as strong, obviously a little bit older, closer to me in age than to Koepka at this point. And he puts himself into play pretty frequently. He hits it pretty far. He makes the game look pretty easy. But when he gets close to winning, particularly in major championships, he clams up. Probably having his brother on the bag as a caddy is not a help, because he puts himself in situations where you need to be very delicate. And it came up on multiple par threes in this tournament where he was trying to make a charge or he was in the middle of a rally and Austin, his caddy's brother, handed him the wrong club for the situation. Or Dustin nuked the club that was what he thought called for in the situation. That happened on the par three to close out, where he put himself in a position to hit, I think he was going to hit 4-iron and turn into a 5-iron and still nuked it over the green. And that was an instant bogey. You knew that was going to happen as soon as it went over the green. And he doesn't manage himself particularly well, and it doesn't help that Austin is not much of a manager caddy. And so Dustin kind of doesn't know what to do in those spots, how to manage to get to the finish. And that's why he has now the career runner-up Grand Slam. He's been second in all four majors now. Wahoo! Or so he said to John McGinnis, who kind of playfully asked him about it. Yay, I'm so excited! And it puts him in the company of seven other players who have a runner-up in at least every major championship. And Louis Oosthuizen was the last guy to do it. He decided to sing Adele after he did it. In this case, Dustin just seemed kind of sarcastic about it. And that does tell you one thing. He's playing great. He played great in both the first two majors of this year. He loves Pebble Beach. Maybe that tells us something. Maybe he will win the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. I mean, he needs some sense of redemption for that 82 in the final round in 2010 when it looked like maybe this was going to be his coming out party at a place that he loved even then. He still loves Pebble Beach, and I think that's going to be a great venue for him. And then you kind of look at Tiger. Tiger was not prepared. He was not prepared to play in this major championship, not only beforehand, but the week of. He didn't play any competitive golf between the Masters and the PGA Championship. He was entered in the Wells Fargo briefly and then chose not to play. And he pulled out basically with the notion that he wasn't mentally prepared to play. I would argue he probably wasn't physically prepared to play either because he hadn't been spending a whole lot of time working on his game after winning the Masters. And I'm not blaming him for that. Suddenly winning the Masters after 14 years and ending an 11-year skid to win a 15th major championship you might have never thought was coming, that's a pretty big deal. You are entitled to take as much time as you want to celebrate that. You can celebrate that for the rest of your life. No one would begrudge you. But when he decided to come to Bethpage, he came a little early. He docked his boat, his privacy yacht, $20 million yacht, in a marina and a harbor. He went over a couple of days, kind of checked out the golf course, and then he played one 9-hole round on Monday, which was smart to get out in front of the bad weather. It was a washout otherwise. And then he chose not to play any kind of practice session. Didn't even see the golf course on Tuesday and Wednesday. And that probably left him at a disadvantage because you're not out there studying. You're not there dialed in thinking about the golf course. You're not there seeing what's going on. You're not there getting a feel for the guys who maybe have it or don't have it. None of that was going on. And so he shows up on Thursday. He gets on the driving range. Koepka rolls up right next to him and says, "Get a load of this. This is what you're looking at all day." And didn't stand behind Tiger so that Tiger was to his right. He went to the right of Tiger. So Tiger had to look at Brooks hitting the piss out the ball with the driver, looking good, swinging well, looking confident, and then goes out on that golf course and just absolutely stripe shows it and ends the golf tournament right away. I mean, 63 on Thursday, make no mistake, was the end of the golf tournament. It was over from there. To pile on a 65 to shoot the first sub-130 36-hole total in a major championship, at least for the first 2 days, is unbelievable given the company. He beat Tiger Woods by 17 shots. He went there to make a statement, whether that was to Tiger, whether that was to Brandel Chamblee, to all the haters and doubters, I don't know, whoever he had as a chip on his shoulder about, and he's got a lot of them, but it made a statement. I think Tiger took that in stride. I think he was probably very impressed by what Koepka did, and he said as much in his commentary after both rounds. When he went home, I mean, he played like a guy who had not played competitive golf, could not find an answer on the fly to get into the fairways, and putted like garbage. I mean, and hit wedges like garbage. He probably gave up missing the cut, if not breaking par the first two rounds, just based on poor putting, chipping, and wedge play. So that tells you he was not prepared for this championship, because at a minimum, if he had a physical problem, if his back was messed up or he didn't feel great, and I don't think that was the case, he would have worked on a short game. He would have worked on wedge play. He would have worked on putting and chipping, because that's the thing you can work on. That's the thing you can do a lot of reps of without a lot of stress. And so he didn't do that and put himself behind the eight ball. And that left him in a position to miss the cut. So I think Tiger probably has to say to himself, look, I didn't do what I needed to do to get ready for this. This is an anomaly. This is the first year of the PGA Championship in May. So what I've got to do from here is figure out a system forward. And that probably is making sure I stay committed to Wells Fargo, regardless of what happens in the Masters. Go play that tournament. It is a PGA Championship host from 2017, so there is some apropos carryover to whatever the PGA Championship venue is going to be that year. Next year, it's TPC Harding Park in San Francisco. And get yourself one tournament rep, that tournament, before going to the PGA. End of story. Cool. So he goes to the U.S. Open in June. He's going to play Memorial. It's a tournament he's won 5 times. It was a tournament last year where he contended going into the weekend and had the lead alone. So that was one of those kind of highlight markers for him on the comeback trail last year. So maybe he can do one better, win it for a 6th time, put himself in position to go out to Pebble Beach, not worried about Sam Snead's mark, not that he is concerned about it, but he'll have that tied, then he can worry about trying to win a Pebble again. Again, a course where he had his virtuoso masterpiece performance of winning the 2000 U.S. Open by full 15 shots. That's 19 years ago, I understand. But the greatest major championship performance we've ever seen was at that golf course by that guy. That can't but help his psyche going into the third major of the year. And then you think about kind of who else is left. I mean, at this point, I don't know that there's anyone worth really talking about on a consistent basis. That wouldn't be a surprise winning a major championship right now. Patrick Cantlay had a great week. He did pretty much what we thought he was going to do. Put himself into contention and unfortunately just ran into a buzzsaw in Brooks Koepka in horrible conditions on Sunday. It was kind of hard to make a move against those two things. Xander Schauffele played the first 3 rounds where he improved every round. And he otherwise, were Koepka not in the field, would have put himself in position to win the golf tournament. And it just so happened that Brooks Koepka shot 128 for the first 36 and ended things. And then you've got guys who have kind of been perpetually part of the conversation. Tony Finau had a great last couple of years, was not really a factor in this, and has kind of been in the wilderness a little bit this year. Ricky Fowler's had a great year in terms of fairly consistent results, but was never part of the story. Tommy Fleetwood showed some signs and then just kind of backtracked. Justin Rose had a horrible Sunday, just another victim of the difficult weather conditions and likely playing for second. But let's talk about Jordan Spieth for a minute. Jordan Spieth did some encouraging things if you look at it on the surface at Bethpage Black. He got himself into the final group on Saturday. Pretty remarkable. He didn't entirely blow up on Saturday. He didn't play great. I mean, he did not play as nearly well from Thursday to Friday to Saturday. And that has been the story of his year. Is pretty good, really great on Thursday, Friday. Not so good on Saturday. Horrible on Sunday. It wasn't so great on Saturday. Koepka shot 70. Spieth wasn't even close to that. Kind of lost a lot of the touch that he had demonstrated earlier in the week. Still led the field in strokes gained putting, by the way, which is probably the lone reason why he contended. It wasn't because of his ball striking. And he didn't play that poorly on Sunday. So he you could tell he was fighting it on Sunday. Put up a good number. Do this for your mental health as much as anything else. Screw the paycheck. Doesn't matter. He's got plenty of money. He's got 3 majors. He's a Hall of Famer at this mid-20s. Don't worry. None of that is in his mind. It's, can I get this right? Can I get this Sunday right when it counts and have a good finish? And just for me, because I'm not going to catch Koepka. He wasn't nowhere near position to get Koepka unless he shot what Harold Varner the third shot, 81. Just wasn't going to happen. So for Spieth, it was just a matter of making birdies and pars and not letting Sunday get to you. Now the question mark is, did Sunday not get to him because he knew he was going to lose? Or did Sunday not get to him because it's fixed? Spieth has been adamant, or was adamant, throughout the course of the week that he is through past tense whatever slump he's been on the last couple of years. And you kind of have to listen to a golfer when they tell you they think they're close, because they're not lying to you. They're not just spewing crap out their mouth. They're telling you something. They're trying to tell you something good's about to happen. But for Spieth, the formula for something good happening is so heavily predicated on strokes gained putting. I mean, that's the reason why he was in this at all. Strokes gained putting was high on relatively flat, relatively simple greens. Well, Pebble Beach is kind of like that. The greens aren't particularly tricky. I mean, Poa's tricky, but the greens themselves aren't that tricky. So maybe that's a good thing for Pebble Beach. You have some room to play off the tee. That's different than what he experienced at Bethpage. That might be helpful. It depends on what the USGA does, of course, but that would be helpful. And he's not a bad ball striker. I mean, a couple seasons ago, he's number one on the PGA Tour in ball striking. You know, the strokes gained on the approach. And that was not really what got him here this week. I mean, you look at the stat line, you can tell. So there's some pluses and minuses for Spieth, but a third place finish in a major championship is great. And this is the one he needs to win to complete the career Grand Slam. So these have to be some positive vibes moving forward for him, whether they translate whatsoever. I think we kind of start to get a sense this week at Colonial, which is a golf course that he's won on in the past. He's had some miracle finishes to win in the past. His one win here was a miracle finish to win. But I'm curious if it'll carry over in a tournament, again, where there's not a lot of inherent pressure because of being a major, but there is some pressure because he's a Texan, and he plays the Texas events because he's a good sponsor kid, and he does what is right by Texas golf. And so it'll be interesting to see if he kind of takes that momentum from Bethpage and moves forward with it and starts posting top 30 finishes more frequently, or he continues to have this kind of weekend slide. It's not going to be permanent. Spieth's not going to be some guy that for the rest of eternity just wilts on the weekend. I don't think. I mean, he's just too good for that. He's too intelligent for that to happen forever, I think. But we'll get a sense of that starting this week. And I think that the only potential downside of having a good week at the PGA is, what if you have a reversion? What if you, over the next few weeks, getting ready for the U.S. Open, go back to bad Spieth on the weekend, and you have some problems? And if that turns out to be the case, I think you're psychologically damaged even further going to the U.S. Open, where if you put yourself into contention to win, you go, oh, there's a weekend. And I'm very curious how that's going to work out for him. I don't know that it will or won't, but that was the one guy I thought about other than Brooks Koepka that I thought mattered for this championship. Dustin Johnson is Dustin Johnson. He is who he is, and that's not changing. He's going to be a huge tease who gets close and gets everyone riled up. And because he puts off this aura that he doesn't really care, or that he's so laid back, it's just not true. It doesn't play out that way in how he competes. He may look placid, but his heart's racing because the adrenaline was pumping and he nuked multiple greens with a chance to win. That's not saying he's a bad player. It's just really hard to do. And he's demonstrated now basically over a decade that when he gets himself into position to win, something goes wrong most of the time. And the only thing that really helped him avoid having something go wrong in a major championship was being told in the middle of the round by the USGA, we're going to screw you. And it gave him a different enemy to worry about, the USGA, so that he could play to peak performance. It's different when your enemy is someone that you can't look at and you can't see on the leaderboard. It just is. And so for Dustin, the enemy was clear. It was Brooks, and he was coming. Even if he was coming back, he was still coming. And when the road rose for Dustin Johnson to meet Koepka, he wilted. That doesn't mean he's a bad player. I'm not trying to say that. But it is indicative of what he has done in major championships in his career. So Brooks Koepka goes into the U.S. Open. He's the two-time defending champion. It's a course that's probably a little outside of his comfort zone in some respects, but not that different. I mean, he can hit a cut on a lot of holes. There's also some seaside holes where a cut goes in the ocean, but especially on the front nine. But by and large, he can play his brand of golf and really not deal with a whole lot of problems. He just can. I mean, he can dominate that golf course in a way that Tiger Woods did, that Dustin Johnson has in regular tour events. It's going to be a similar formula. And he only seems to grow confident by the day that what he's doing is impossible to stop. He said early in the week before the major, before it started, I'm the guy to beat. I think I can get to 10 majors. And I get ticked off when people disrespect me. And sure enough, he had all the ammo he needed. He probably had it from Tiger winning the Masters, but he could have added the ammo from Brandel Chamblee doing, what was that, podcast or something, saying that he thought that the only two guys that could really challenge Tiger from here were Dustin and Rory. Well, to not include Brooks in that conversation, I believe is kind of foolish. I mean, it's Brandel's opinion, but I thought it was a foolish one, and not because it gave Koepka additional motivation and encouraged him to fire up Photoshop on his phone and put a clown nose on Brandel, but in that it was just wrong. I mean, Brooks is the best player right now. Tiger is the world number one if you take away the restrictor plates, so to speak, of the official world golf ranking formula. But it's darn close who's number one. And that's with, what, four majors won in 24 months? In the current ranking period, he has four majors won. But because he's so random week to week on the PGA Tour, that's why he wouldn't necessarily be the number one ranked golfer without the restriction of Tiger Woods' lack of starts in the official World Golf Ranking formula. Tiger's more consistent week to week. He's pretty much good all the time. This obviously excluded the lack of preparation considered, but Brooks and Tiger in majors, I mean, if you look at the story of the last four, Brooks is the story of the last four, basically, with the exception of the Open Championship. Wasn't part of that, really. I mean, he was just there to be there making money. But if you look at the story of the last eight, pretty much Brooks. I mean, you take away the Masters last year because he couldn't play. You take away the Open. That's pretty much him. That's it. And so that makes him the best player on the planet right now, at least when it comes to these big tournaments. And Brooks is going to continue to find a way to be motivated because he'll take the spite of the Bethpage fans chanting for DJ when he got close and they wanted some kind of drama on Sunday, which they got for about 40 minutes. And he'll take that and say, well, why weren't you cheering for me to just put this thing down? And he'll go to Pebble and kill everybody by 10 until everyone just kind of bends the knee and says, Brooks, you're the best, man. We just got to go chase you, brother. He's going to have some motivation. And he's going to make mistakes. He's going to screw up. He's not going to win majors at a 50% clip forever. No one does that. But you can go through, at least as best demonstrated, a stretch of 10, 12 majors where you can win about half of them. Tiger won 7 of 11. Jack just kind of peeled away at it over time. 2 here, 3 there, 1 here. That was how he did things. It wasn't ever just, I'm going on a huge run, and then I'll just pick up the pieces and get to 18. He won over a long period of time, and he did it in little spurts. Brooks is looking like the guy who's going to be the opposite. He's going to go through some undisclosed period of time where he's just practically uncatchable, and then something's going to change. Either someone's going to catch him, someone's going to get better, he's going to get worse. Something will change. Maybe he gets injured. Maybe he gets into a marriage with Jenna Sims that doesn't work out so well. Those are the kinds of things that tend to stop players. It's not that their game changes, it's that their mind changes. And that's really it. I mean, other than a crippling injury, Brooks Koepka is going to be the same golfer he's been for another 10 years before it starts to have to change. That's pretty incredible. So that gives him 40 majors. And you're telling me you don't think he can win 6 from here, 6 of 40? I mean, I know that's a 15% clip, and that's still amazing, but does that seem all that out of this world to you anymore? We said that when Rory won 2 in a row to end 2014, I realize, and I figured at that point he could probably top out in the 9-10 major range at that point. Well, probably not going to get there unless he suddenly changes and becomes a suddenly good wedge player and putter in the next 12 months. Or he just rides out the storm for Brooks Koepka and waits until he flounders and then he's the guy left. Who knows? But it seems like moving forward, this is Brooks' world in major championships, and he should be the favorite until otherwise indicated. And looks like he's going to be for the U.S. Open. Right now he's like 5 or 6 to 1, depending on the book you look at. So that's pretty incredible. That's a pretty incredible turnaround. That's a pretty incredible story from a guy who was barely lauded out of Florida State despite great ACC performances and credentials, goes to the European Challenge Tour, gets to the European Tour, wins in Turkey, gets to the U.S., hangs out, starts kind of performing, and then all of a sudden wins majors at a sick clip. It's a remarkable story. He's not the most interesting / engaging guy in the world in a public setting. He's here to do a job. He's not here to make friends. He's here to win, and win often on the biggest stages of golf, because he doesn't have an equipment deal. He doesn't have a lot of sponsors that he has to appeal to and kiss butts of. He can wear Nike stuff, which speaks for itself. He plays his own clubs because no one's going to pay him what it takes to get out of the clubs that he loves right now because he's winning with them. And all he's got to focus on is cashing checks from the PGA Tour, the PGA of America, the USGA, the RNA, and Augusta National Golf Club. And he's doing it. He's doing it right now. And so I think that clarity of purpose, that clarity of time is going to help him for years and years to come. It's really going to be a dangerous thing. All right, so I want to shift gears really quick for the last half of this show to talk about the U.S. Senior Women's Open and preface all of this by saying I had the opportunity to speak with Kari Webb of the U.S. Senior Women's Open on Sunday afternoon. It was great. The USGA invited her down for the, or up, I guess, from Florida for the weekend, I think. I don't know if it was the whole week. I think just the weekend. And she spoke with me for about 12 minutes. I'm going to do a story on it, but I want to put the raw audio up, so it'll be up for GNM Plus members on the first GNM Plus podcast, basically. So if you want to sign up for that, head over to thegolfnewsnet.com/GNN-plus and find out more. You can look at the navigation. You can go to GNM Plus and find out more and sign up there. $5 a month, $50 a year. It's really a good deal for what we're going to be bringing in terms of content, but it's a good conversation. So anyway, I preface all of this with that. But I chose to cover the U.S. Senior Women's Open this past week over Beth Page for the simple reason that last year when I went in July to the first Senior Women's Open, it was one of the greatest golf tournaments I've ever been to, one of the greatest experiences. It was happy. It was a festival of golf. It was a great crowd. It was a good vibe. It was just different than covering a men's under 50 major championship. And I think for me, that was what I'm looking for at this point in my life. I'm not looking to just cover something because it's prestigious. I'm looking to cover something because it's interesting and different and fun. And this was that. And so I said to myself, well, as long as this tournament is going on and has me captivated, has me interested in how this works, I'm going to go and compete. I'm going to go and cover it. And when they announced it was at Pine Needles in May, opposite the PGA Championship, I said, well, I'm still going to do it. I want to go check out the Pinehurst region. I hadn't been there in 8 years until March for the media day, and then obviously for last week. Got a VRBO, had a great condo off of Pinehurst number 4, which was totally reasonable, by the way, if you're ever thinking about going to Pinehurst. And wanted to intersperse covering the tournament with getting to experience some golf in that part of the world. And I was very happy in the end that I went and covered that tournament. For one, it was only myself and Ron Syrak there the entire time in terms of actual media, actual journalists. There was one local guy who came in for the weekend. And Steve Eubanks from Global Golf Post was there for a couple of days, but he wasn't there for the weekend. And still wrote something, but he wasn't there until the end. And the crowds were a little bit different than last year at Chicago Golf Club, in part because it's a much more spread out property. There's a lot more just topography. I mean, it's just, there's more ups and downs, there's more hills. That's why it's the sand hills of North Carolina. And it just routes differently than Chicago Golf Club, which is a lot of back and forth, up and back, around, parallel holes. There's not a whole lot of that at Pine Needles. But they chose Pine Needles because Peggy Kirk-Bell, who died, I think, 3 years ago, is now going to go in the World Golf Hall of Fame this year. She was the owner of this resort, and now her family owns it. Her children do. But she owned this resort for 50, 60 years and hosted 3 U.S. Women's Opens there, all of them won by really great players, Kari Webb, Annika, Christy Kerr, and they're going to have another one there. And they were honored to host this event because they've done so much for women's golf over the years, giving players a place to play. They have Donna Andrews now, former major champion, who is their teaching professional. So they have this kind of amazing commitment to growing women's golf and just being in one of the best places in the world for golf. It all kind of made sense. The crowds were different. Pinehurst is not Chicago. It has very little permanent population. There are obviously lots of folks who are tourists who come in to play golf, and some of them came. I mean, there are probably a few thousand people each day that came, probably slightly fewer than the number that came to Chicago Golf Club last year, and it probably looked more sparse on TV because, again, everything was so spread out. It also didn't help that it was really freaking hot on the weekend. I mean, it was 90 to 95 both days on the weekend. So for people that wanted to get out, and I mean, to be honest, the clientele of Pinehurst is not young. You're older and richer. And so you're also more likely to not want to go hang out in 90-degree weather and walk around a golf course where you gotta chug water just to make sure you stay hydrated. And so the crowds were not quite as much as I would have hoped, but the golf was really good. Helen Alfredson won. Helen Alfredson doesn't play competitive golf anymore, other than these two senior majors, the Senior Women's Open and the Senior LPGA, which is in the fall at French Lick in Indiana, where I'll be going in July. And she just doesn't play competitively. She doesn't have it. She hasn't done it in 6 years. She doesn't have any interest in that. She just wants to be at home, either in Florida in the Orlando area or in Sweden with her, with her husband, and go have some fun, drink wine, have a good time, enjoy retirement. And that's what she's been doing. But she comes back and plays these, and she had to kind of match wits on Sunday with Trish Johnson, who still plays maybe 10, 12 tournaments a year between the Ladies European Tour and the Senior Events and the Legends Tour. And these two majors. You got Julie Inkster, who is still grinding it out a little bit on the LPGA. She plays a very select schedule now. It's kind of starting to walk away from all of that. You got Laura Davies, who still plays a relatively full schedule between the LPGA and a few LET events, and won this tournament last year. And then you've got a kind of interspersed number of pros who you might recognize, might not recognize, depending on how much you follow the LPGA over the years. But you've got Daniela Makapany, who was close. Jane Crafter, who was, we'll get back to in a second, who played and has done well in the Legends Tour and some obviously limited number of starts. They don't have a huge number of events. They don't have a huge schedule. And some other pros who played pretty well for not playing a whole lot of competitive golf because they don't have access to a tour that's full and robust of events. I mean, the Legends Tour has like six events. Two of them are the majors that they don't really put on. And then you've got these one-day team events or one-day events or 36-hole events. All of them have carts. It's just a different animal, and there's just not a lot of money involved. So if you're a professional golfer, you can probably make more money giving lessons, teaching golf, and doing other stuff than trying to chase down these handful of events on the Legends Tour. And so without many places to play, you're playing a 72-hole walking event in 90-degree weather on a really difficult golf course set up by the USGA. No wonder the winning score was over par. It's a miracle. It was just one over par. They got it kind of to the borderline on Thursday, where players were getting embarrassed because the greens were so quick and the contours and the grain just worked so crazy together. Kyle France did an amazing job with that golf course, but they played it to the edge. And then they kind of dialed it back a little bit for Friday and Saturday, maybe ratcheted up a little bit for Sunday. But just a really difficult test. And it was fun to watch these players try to figure it out. Because the challenge of Pine Needles isn't going from tee to green. You're going to hit a lot of fairways. They're pretty darn wide. There's no rough to speak of. There's Pine Needles, but the fairways are 40, 50 yards wide. You really have no reason, if you're a professional golfer, to not hit the fairway. And then you realize, once you get into certain positions, that, yeah, you hit the fairway, and now you're screwed because you have a terrible angle into a hole location that the only place you can miss on that golf course is short and straight. Otherwise, you're going to have a lot of weird chips and putts and decisions to make and speed you can't control. And that's what happened to a lot of players. They would get in a bad position and then put themselves in a worse position closer to the hole, barely get on, two putt, three putt, some four putts, some putts off the green. That was where the penalties came. But for Helen, she played so great down the stretch. After a bogey on five, double bogey on five, rather, she said she kind of looked at the board and realized she hadn't really been passed. She was still in charge with Trish Johnson, who she played with in the final group. And so all of a sudden, she realized she could win because there was no reason to think that anyone was going to run away with it despite her double. For there, she made 13 pars in a row. And they weren't stress-free. I mean, there were some tough moments, some tough putts to make, and she had some birdie putts that would have allowed her to make it a little bit more stress-free. But her putting was so rickety, and you could tell she was really stressed and nervous. I mean, she emphasized that pretty heavily after she had won. She just couldn't handle the stress, that she was trying to figure out what to do because she's so out of practice relative to handling that kind of stuff. But that she did it, and that she got there in the end, and she won. She won $180,000. The purse is $1 million. If you look at the purse for most Legends Tour events, it ain't anywhere near that. Even the Senior LPGA Championship, which is great, has a purse of $600,000. The winner gets 90 grand based on a 15% payout. The USGA does 18% on $1 million, so the winner's check for the Senior Women's Open is double the Senior LPGA Championship. It's pretty wild. It's a big deal. And so for players beyond those maybe handful who had really good LPGA careers, won majors, won events, have a fair amount of money to live off of the rest of the way, it's not as big of a deal to cash a big check. And I'm not saying it's a big deal for Jane Crafter, but to watch her finish T4 with a great putt at the last to save par, it was really gratifying, really cool. I mean, I've got to know Jane a little bit through Twitter. She does a great job on PGA Tour Live. She'd worked with PGA Tour Radio over the years. She said they let her go at the end of last year. But so she's done some PGA Tour Live stuff this year and is doing more of it. She's really good at it. And she's done commentary over in Australia. She's really good at that. And she analyzes and understands the game very well. And I think that's in part because she's not a long hitter. And so she thinks her way around the golf course better than most people, way better than I do, because I just go smash, hit, putt. But she thinks her way around. And you could see her ball striking throughout the course of the week. I mean, I watched her probably play 5 to 7 holes every day. Not as much on Sunday because I was trying to kind of work a few things, but just really incredible. Really incredible to watch. And just to see her be happy about what she did, just to be over the moon, because she hadn't played competitive golf since last October, the Senior LPGA, just trying to prepare the best way that she can. She lives in Arizona in the mountains, so she doesn't get a ton of reps, obviously, and she's working, she's doing other stuff, she's living her life. And for her to be able to do this at Pine Needles, a place where she lived and played for 12 years, because Peggy Kirkbell gave her a place to play, gave her a home, and she was very emotional about that after the final round, just borderline tearing up about it, because what it meant for her to deliver a good performance in Peggy Kirkbell's memory and Bullet Bell's memory. I thought that was really awesome. And I just wanted to give her a shout out as someone who is one of the nicest people I've ever met in this game and who is so darn skilled but has so few opportunities to play because of the unfortunate realities of the business of pro golf right now. She kicked ass. And I'm very happy for her. And I think I looked at the money yesterday. Something like 45, 46 grand, which isn't a bad for 4 days a week. She doesn't need the money. That's not the point. But it's pretty cool to be able to finish T4 in a tournament where you're competing against basically a handful of players who have won majors, who are still active and get a fair amount of competitive golf in each year. And you just come in off the street with as much prep as you can possibly do, given all of those restrictions and your actual schedule. And you finished T4. That was awesome. I was so happy to see that. So I just wanted to give a shout out to Jane for what she accomplished. And thanks to the USGA for putting on the tournament. The USGA gets maligned pretty frequently, and it's pretty easy to do. I mean, they make mistakes. They're people too. And they've kind of come under the gun for some mistakes in the US Open, particularly last year. I don't think 2017 was a mistake, but they've come under the gun for some issues in the Open. 2015, 2017 was perceived to be too easy. It wasn't their fault. 2018 was borderline, probably too hard, and we'll see what happens with Pebble Beach, but they do some really good stuff, and what they're doing with the Senior Women's Open is wonderful and appreciated. They have a stated goal to get the U.S. Women's Open purse much closer, and I can't kind of detail all of that, but much closer to the U.S. Open purse in the coming years. It's not like a one-year thing. It's not going to jump from like $5 million to $10 million, but they're going to work their way toward it. It's a stated goal. I think that's great because the future of this sport is not the one. It's not in its past. It's not entirely rooted in its past. From a participatory angle, the future of this sport involves more people than white men. Old white men. You've got to get young people to play. You've got to get women to play. You have to have minorities play because this country is changing. And if you're not paying attention, you're all of a sudden going to find that old white dudes are maybe a rich minority, but they are an ultra minority. And so for this game, which has a lot of affordable components to it, despite talking about all of these incredible places, The average green fee is $27. So the future of this sport is attracting people from the middle class to come play, to do something that's leisurely and takes time out of their schedule. And we need to be welcoming and encouraging and putting forward great players that look like America. And that involves having women of all ages. That involves having minorities. That involves having young people. And so kudos to the USGA for kind of rounding out their championships and actively working toward a mission to put great golf forward regardless of who you are and the tees that you play from and where you came from. I really appreciate all of that. Now, quickly, and I will probably get into this into a separate podcast, but the golf, oh man, this will be a GNN Plus podcast, but the golf in Pinehurst and Pine Needles and Southern Pines and Aberdeen and Sanford, wow, man. I got to play Pinehurst number 8, Pinehurst number 4, Tobacco Road. Wow, what a great, great, great experience of playing those golf courses. I'll talk a little bit about that in a GNN Plus podcast, but thank you so much to the Pinehurst Resort, to Alex, for their big social media guy, their media guy. And he helped the Women's Open, too. I mean, he helped run down players to do interviews. He is a man of many, many talents, but thank you for getting me on both number 4 and number 8. Wonderful, wonderful courses. Gil Hance did such a good job with number 4. I mean, if you read my take on Stream Song Black, not the biggest fan, not a huge detractor, but not the biggest fan. Felt kind of arbitrary in the greens. And this did not. It was completely scoreable. It had this different land movement than so much of Pinehurst, especially compared to number 2. It was fair. There was plenty of opportunity to take on risk without necessarily it being a do-or-die shot. It was just great. Number 8 was a lot of fun. Totally different look. Tom Fazio designed it. There's a lot of kind of blind shots that you kind of have to learn a little bit to be able to play it, but the conditioning was superior. It was a very good golf course, and it has a totally different feel than numbers 2 and 4. The Cradle, such a great atmosphere, the little par 3 course. Thistledew, the putting course, both right next to each other. Music blaring, beer out, just a fun, fun place to be. And then Tobacco Road, man. Darren Bunch and Mitch Lawrence have told me about this golf course for years now. I finally got a chance to play it. Thank you to Mark Stewart, who owns the property, for letting me come and play. I shot the round of my life. I shot a 66 at Tobacco Road. That's beyond. Just beyond. I did everything right that day. I was a fiend on approach shots. Played fearless golf. Made everything that I need. Well, I still left a few out there, but made pretty much everything. And it just, oh, what a great golf trip. Whether you're going alone, and I think there's some value in talking about the one-person golf trip, whether you're going alone, with buddies, whatever it is, to be able to play three courses like that in a week and be able to see some of the best golfers in the world in history compete against each other, that's a pretty darn good week. So that's all of that is why I did the U.S. Senior Women's Open instead of the PGA Championship at Bethpage, which I'm sure was lovely and great. And Long Island has an incredible amount of golf. Great public, private places to play. But I'm so happy I went to Pinehurst. And hopefully you enjoyed the coverage. And hopefully you enjoyed this podcast, because we're going to wrap it up from here. So next time we talk, we'll talk a little bit about what happened at Colonial, at least in the public version of this podcast. We will put up the Kari Webb interview. I'll talk a little bit more about the courses from Pinehurst, that part of the trip, in a separate GNN Plus podcast later this week. So if you do wish to sign up for that and get access to that feed in addition to these public episodes, head over to thegolfnewsnet.com, check out the GNN Plus page, and sign up. And you can pay for $5 a month, and we'll give you a great window into what we're going to be doing in the future with GNN Plus. So please check it out if you can over at thegolfnewsnet.com. Until next time, I'm Ryan Balanchine saying thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.